My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. This is the 283rd episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guests are the dynamic duo behind a new neighborhood brasserie in Brooklyn, and I will introduce them fully in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speedrun game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to stay the course. Let's follow our visions and not deter from them, no matter what obstacles may come our way or challenges we may face. Life is full of curveballs, and we shouldn't ever let them steer us off our path. If we have a dream and we believe in it, that's all that matters. So let's put in the work and go for it. As Starship says, nothing's gonna stop us now. That's my tip today. Now I'm really excited. I am on location today at Francie, a neighborhood brasserie that opened in December 2020 in South Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And I'm here with two guests. I'm with Francie's chef owner, Chris Cipollone, and owner-operator John Winterman. Francie is their first independent collaboration together. Chris was formerly the executive chef at the Michelin-starred Peoria in New York City, earning 2 stars from the New York Times. Prior, he was the executive chef of Michael Tusk's Cotonia in San Francisco, which is one of the city's most highly rated and longtime staple restaurants. And John was the managing partner at the James Beard Award-winning Michelin-starred Batard and built his expertise of 20 plus years of restaurant management and hospitality at celebrated restaurants such as Charlie Trotter, Gary Danko, and Restaurant Danielle. Prior to Batard, he was the maitre d' at Restaurant Danielle and Cafe Baloo. Without further ado, hi guys.
Good afternoon.
It's so good to be here, to be live with you. So I always love to start out and find out people's background and how they got into what they're doing today. So Chris, do you want to take us back a bit as to what led you to become a chef?
Well, what led me to become a chef? Well, I probably would have to attribute that to my parents. I grew up as an only child. Parents owned a wine shop in Westchester, New York. So they were always into food and wine, took me to restaurants. As a little kid, they had a lot of friends with a lot of chefs, so I kind of got enamored with that lifestyle that I lead now, and I just kind of took to it as my mother cooked, and I would cook for myself a lot because they worked a lot, and it just kind of snowballed from there. My interest, you know, continued.
And John?
How far back do you want to go?
How far back do you want to take us?
Well, it's more than 20 years, so I like to say I got fired from my first restaurant job in 1986.
Okay. So you got the 20-plus in the bio.
20-plus in the bio, yeah.
I was 6 years old when you got fired.
You know, the start was really more in college. It was a curiosity, and I'd say at best my mother cooked well-balanced meals, where you know, I can remember distinctly the first time I tried foie gras working for Charlie Trotter, the first time I tried, you know, a collectible wine. So the curiosity really drove me through at the onset, and then the type of people with whom I was able to work really gave me a lot of inspiration.
Yeah, well, we have the Charlie Trotter thing in common, even though we didn't overlap.
We did not, no.
Which is kind of hard to believe. The year I was there, you were gone. Was he a mentor, or who were some of your mentors?
Yeah, actually, I feel like I was looking at this question earlier. We could probably do an entire show just based on that, and I can give you a list of 100 names and tell you exactly why this person inspired me in certain ways. I would consider Charlie one of the mentors for certain reasons. You know, I think the people I've worked with, whether it's people I keep in touch with through my experience at Trotters or Danko or Danielle or even through my partnership with Batard, you know, you find people that have such an intense commitment to the hospitality that it's almost perverse, you know, and those are the people I gravitate towards because I feel like I can learn from them.
Yeah. What about you, Chris?
Early mentors, it'd have to be, see, when I was coming up in restaurants, I worked for a lot of really amazing chefs that didn't get any recognition, or didn't get the recognition they deserved, for sure. Namely, two chefs, Jerry Borkney and William Savarese, were two guys that I worked for in younger years, when I was like 16 up to like 21, at two restaurants, Crabtree's Kittle House and La Cremaire in Chappaqua. And they were, as far as cooking, they were like my rock foundation of like the old school way of cooking, and that was what really solidified me as wanting to do this for the rest of my life. And then, like John said, the countless other people I've worked with, worked for, kind of kept me inspired.
Right. So, how did you two come to collaborate?
We answered a Tinder ad together. No.
Oh, wow. Amazing. Good to know it works.
We have a mutual friend that introduced us. You know, I was looking at a space and was looking for a chef partner, and unbeknownst to me, Chris was looking for a space and looking for a partner, and our mutual friend got us in touch with each other, and we started looking for space together. And I think the first space we looked at fell through, and we probably could have easily shaken hands and walked our different directions, but we just kind of said, okay, I guess we're partners now. And
it was pretty
here
easy.
We are.
That was the easiest thing about this whole thing.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, it seems like it's going to be the hardest thing, but that was, you know, that time period went really fast. It's not the normal. It wasn't the normal, we're going to go look at space for the next 2 years and try to line up all the money. That happened pretty quickly. And it happened fairly organically. It was just the referrals from mutual friends.
Yeah, so. That's great. So were you looking in Manhattan and Brooklyn, or were you just set on trying something different in Williamsburg?
We looked in both.
Both.
Yeah.
Both.
We saw a couple of different spaces in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And I think one other space in Brooklyn before we settled on this one.
Yeah, well, both of you, your experience is from Manhattan. So what has it been like? I mean, was that something you were kind of excited about to try to open a Brooklyn restaurant? And how's it been compared?
Go ahead.
I mean, for me, a lot of it had to do with when I moved back from San Francisco to New York. I moved to Queens, which is a place I never thought I'd live, just because it never struck me as a place to go, and I really fell in love with it in living in the boroughs and experiencing Brooklyn and Queens from that side of it, instead of just going to visit after living in Manhattan for so many years. And it felt organic that I wanted to like cook in a more of a neighborhood feel, I met my wife in Williamsburg, and like down the street from this space, and it all just kind of came together, and I was like, and I figured that this would be a great spot to kind of set roots, because that was like the reason of moving back. It's like I was very sure that I wanted to invest and create something for the city I love and I grew up in. So
right. So how did you guys come up with the concept and the menu and the whole feel of the place? Was it, I mean, was your vision the same from the get-go, I guess?
I think it was similar. It was it definitely dovetailed in a lot of places, so there wasn't a lot of compromise on either end. It was fairly easy to come up with this.
And,
you know, the term brasserie gives you a lot of latitude, and it gives the kitchen the ability to do things that are super simple and tasty that can be served really quickly, and it allows you a certain amount of latitude to delve into some luxury items and some more ambitious project and more ambitious cooking, and allows us to, I think, embrace the melting pot that is the city, where it's not just going to be a French brasserie menu. It's It's a New York brasserie, which is how we term it.
Yeah, and the name, Francie, where did that come from?
I'll give all the credit to Mr. Winterman here. We went back and forth on a million names.
That was a long process, actually. It was like,
that was hard. That's where it started getting complicated.
8 weeks of like, hard. We would just send each other a list of names, just in, I think Chris was delving into like, you know, obscure waterways that ran under the city and Revolutionary War officers and all sorts of things, try to like pick up something from the history of the neighborhood. And we were just Googling everything you can imagine to try to figure out something. And we were like looking at literary references, and that's where that popped up, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which happened to be take place in this neighborhood, which ended up being a great fit.
Yeah. So talk a little about the menu, Chris, because I've now been here twice. I'm a regular,
yes.
Even though you've only been, you'll tell me how many services you've now had.
What's it, like a month?
Yeah.
Realistically, this is our, not including December,
is our sixth week.
Yeah.
No, I'm very proud to have been here twice within like your I think 12 days of being open. But and the food has been amazing. Everything from that market salad you have to the halibut to the desserts. I mean, it's fabulous. So talk about the menu.
The funny thing about the menu was I had this concept of this menu tinkering around in my head for a while, and when John and I got together, John's like, I kind of want to open this like brasserie concept, and I was like, okay, do you like this menu? And he's like, yes, and then that's basically where we how we went.
Easy.
Yeah, how it happened. As far as the menu, I wanted to do something that was a la carte. I didn't want, not that we certainly can't produce tasting menus here, but I really wanted to. I think that's where the way dining is and kind of should be at this point. And I wanted to have it like a choose your own adventure and have fun with the menu and have a bunch of different little sections and kind of like not make it the straightforward narrative of like appetizer, entree, dessert kind of thing. I wanted you to be able to come in and have a different way of eating every single time you come here. So whether you pop in the bar and you just have a couple of snacks, or you come in and you do snacks all the way down to dessert through seven different courses, we can offer that, so that's why the menu is set up the way it is, which I think is fun. And then the items, I try to have a little something for everybody, you know, at least the vegetarians and vegans and the meat eaters and everybody else in between.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what it was like with the pandemic. You were delayed. You got open. You had to close because indoor dining got shut down, and you're not doing outdoor dining because I believe your location just doesn't...
We don't have the clearance for it anyway.
Yeah. So, and then you opened again. I mean, having worked with restaurants for a long time, I know how difficult it is to open a restaurant in normal times, and I feel like the challenges you guys were faced was just unbelievable, so...
But not insurmountable, right?
Yeah. Well, obviously, yes. You've made it. We're here, but I give you a lot of credit.
The hard part was having sort of this serene acceptance of things that were beyond our control and leaving emotion out of it. So all along, we started looking at it as 2-week periods, and as things went on, 2-month periods. So we would talk to the landlord and talk to our investors and, you know, try to make a deal and figure out what's going to happen next. And it was like, okay, here's what we're going to do for June and July. Here's what we're going to do for August and September. And we had to leave emotion out of it, as emotional as we wanted to get, because you would end up making a very rash decision. And what got us to this point was able to separate that and make sure we were making smart decisions.
I don't know what
you want to add to that, but...
It's weird, and... Some of it might be a shock to hear this, but I kind of was never worried, even though it was completely terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, we're still going to open this great restaurant. We're building this great restaurant, and we'll take what gets thrown at us. That's just it. You can't think any other way. So,
well,
here we are.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great attitude, and you've also put together a wonderful team. Where I know several people you've been working with, from Glenn Coben, who worked in your design, to Erica Cantley, who's running the door.
Right.
How did you go about finding who you're going to work with? And
Glenn, I knew from our experience at Batard, and we had kept in touch. And when this space was first available, he did a couple of drawings to help us to sort of determine where the kitchen might be located and how many seats we might get out of it. And, you know, we started looking at those, and that was just done as a friend, where we could at least have an idea going forward, because we do need to know the number of seats and how big the bar is and et cetera, so we can figure out, when we're putting our numbers together, the staffing and the check average and how many customers we might expect to see. So, you know, Glenn was an easy choice to make. I've been friends with him for a long time. As far as the staffing goes, and I'll let Chris answer this as well, of course, you know, I needed to put together a team that had some really great experience, because we were going to be opening with a skeleton staff. So we had to eliminate certain positions in the front of the house and in the back of the house just to get open, because we were going to be at 25% capacity. So we couldn't open with a full staff. So I had to get people in who had some experience and could be sort of cross-pollinate positions, so to speak. So if Erica, you know, can run the book and understands Resi, but at the same time can help polish silverware, it's just an advantage for the whole team.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of hiring one of my best friends, James DiStefano, as my pastry chef.
And you know, he's good.
He's great, and it's, I'm really happy to be back there working with one of my friends all day. And he's the kind of guy that can produce the bread, produce the pastries, also manage the dishwashers, and take care of the invoices and all that stuff. I just knew that we had to have this like kind of crack team that could really take care of it all. I mean, there's only a couple of us back there to produce what we do with Francie, and that's the passion that I was looking for when I was hiring like everything from dishwashers to cooks. It's like, you know, this is going to be a wild ride. Do you want to do this? And I never even hire upon talent specifically. I hire upon drive and attitude, and that's what each one of these individuals has. I can safely say that they push their hardest every day. So that's, it's a special thing.
And you have a beautiful kitchen.
Oh, yeah, it's great. I'm home for sure.
Yeah, it's really nice. Okay, so let me ask you my question for my last guest. On episode 282, I had on Amanda Clute. She's the editor-in-chief of Eater and a senior vice president at Vox Media. She wants to know, how has this experience of opening during the pandemic permanently altered your outlook on your business and this industry? Is there something fundamentally that's changed with how you see the industry after all this is over?
I've been thinking about this question for like the past 24 hours. So. Permanently altered? I think permanently altered is, you know, small businesses and, you know, family-run businesses and independent restaurants really need a safety net in place. We don't have a strong, well-paid lobbying group that's looking out for us. And I think one of the great things that came out of it was the Restaurant Coalition, where you gather the voices and made it a single voice, you know, to advocate for the industry. And I think, you know, really made us, we had benefits we wanted for the staff in place, which will still be in place in the future. But it, you know, it really becomes very important then to offer those benefits to your staff, whether it's a health insurance program or whether it's the ability to contribute to a 401k or paid time off. And I think it very much put a magnifying glass to all the inconsistencies in our industry.
So
I'm hoping going forward we can implement these programs the way we wanted to in the beginning. So.
How about you, Chris?
I'm going to answer this in a positive manner. I think what the permanent thing it's done for restaurants is I generally see people enjoying themselves and having a good time and really appreciating being able to go to a restaurant at this point. A lot of our diners come in here and it's their first time doing indoor dining, and we do do our very best to make sure they feel safe and all that, but also I get to see them really have a great time again. And every table I talk to, we're like, we've missed this so much. And we're all kind of, you know, I think that's a really positive thing. It kind of reminds us how lucky we are when something's taken away from us, so.
Yeah, true, new appreciation.
Yeah.
For sure. So John, you wrote a piece recently in Food and Wine it's entitled, "It's Wrong to No-Show on a Restaurant Reservation, Especially Now." Yes, I agree.
Yes.
So what inspired you to write this piece?
I probably could have written this piece 15 years ago. It's, you know, leaving restaurants aside, it's wrong to no-show on an appointment, you know? You have a dinner date with a friend, you have a doctor's appointment, you have a spa date. It's just common courtesy, I think. It's rude to no-show or offer even a last-minute case cancellation is about as good as a no-show. I wrote it because, you know, at 25% capacity with 6 feet distancing, you know, a restaurant with 40 seats might only be able to seat 8 or 10 covers at a time. You know, we're a little luckier. We have a little bit more spacing so we can seat more people, but if you're and combined with a curfew, you're really restricted on how many people you might see in a given evening. And so if you're going into a night where a restaurant might have, be lucky enough to be in the 20s, like say 24 people, 28 people, and you're sitting there with a reservation of a party of six, that's one quarter of the people you're expecting that night. It's one quarter of the revenue you're expecting that night. It's one quarter of the gratuities for the staff. It's planning on the kitchen side to have product ready, to have product ordered, to have the staff work 2 days in advance to produce that product that's gonna be ready for the day that these people are coming in. And it just seems untenable that somebody would actually do that when they know how bad it is for restaurants and how we're struggling to hold on to business. You know, it just seems, I think tone deaf is the word Glenn has used, the term Glenn has used to describe it. And it's even more frustrating when you can find the person on Instagram and you really want to say something, but we don't say anything. It's just we live with what happens. And you see that they seem to be, at least on social media, very supportive of restaurants. So to have this happen just makes it even more, I think, infuriating, you know, is the right word.
Yeah. I feel you, yeah. For sure.
And it's not that hard. You don't have to actually stop and pick up the phone and call. I mean, all the applications are fairly mm-hmm. easy. Apologies, I'm not going to be able to make my reservation tonight. And the no-show happens because we're already 20 minutes past the reservation time. We have no response whatsoever. And then we just get the word cancel texted to us.
Right.
You know, so it feels insulting. It's hurtful to the staff. Everybody really, really wants to see restaurants bounce back and the city bounce back. And we're still fighting against that lack of courtesy that people seem to have.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you wrote the piece. I think it's important.
It needs to be said. You know, people need to probably improve their manners a little bit. So.
Yeah, well, it's the other people that aren't as appreciative of being here, which is, I feel, the majority of, but it's not, it's a common courtesy for sure.
Yeah, in normal circumstances, you know, we have 100 reservations, there's people at the bar, there's a wait list going, mm-hmm. there's people calling to check to see if they can get in. It's still rude, but at least we can cover it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
At this point, restaurants don't have the chance to cover that. It's just lost revenue.
So. Yeah. So before we take a break, one more question. So what advice would you both give to anyone who wants to get into the restaurant industry, whether it's be a chef, maitre d', an owner? Yeah, what do you think?
Go for it.
You both are like smiling and looking at each other like,
No, the perfect advice is, just like it's with any job, you better have a passion for it. You know, if you want to be a chef, take it to the max. You know, if you want to sell insurance, take it to the max. Like, you really got to, it's one of those jobs that you got to want it. You know, I see it all the time with people, cooks and stuff, coming out of the kitchen, and it's like, well, you know, what's your end goal? You know, what do you want to do? is this your passion? Is this your thing? And anytime they answer me no, I'm like, ooh, then don't, you're young enough, get out. Right. You know? But if you're into it, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I do thank my lucky stars I get to cook in that kitchen every day. And, you know, that's my job. It's mm-hmm. kind of cool to me still. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just be passionate. Follow up.
And John?
I'd say become friendly with the New York City Fire Department.
That's a first. I've heard here, but makes sense.
You know, there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes, and Chris alluded earlier to people coming in, and we've had people tell us that their first dining experience indoors in a year feels like they're on a vacation, right? And that vacation only 2.5 hours long. And that's great because it's super rewarding to affect somebody in that way. But then the next day you come in and like, okay, the toilet doesn't flush, right? Or there's a mess in front that happened the night before on the sidewalk that you have to deal with. And even though it's not your mess, you still have to deal with it because it's our storefront.
Or a sprinkler burst.
Yeah, a sprinkler burst, or you get a frozen pipe, or, you know, and these are the non-romantic sides of the restaurant that you, if you're not prepared to deal with it, this is maybe not the industry for you, you know? On the plus side, I'd say, since it's an art form either way, whether it's the food on the plate or the service, I consider service an art form, you know, it's very subjective. So when you're putting a form of your work out there as an art, you're setting yourself up for criticism, and you cannot take that personally. You know, not everybody's going to agree with how your service goes. Not everybody's going to like the food. And some of it you might think is unfair. But you still are putting something out there into the world. And you're subjected to criticism for that. You can't take it personally. You have to still come in with a passion. You have to still bounce out of bed and be excited about what you're doing every day. And it's hard, but every day I get up and I can't wait to get here because, you know, so many things are changing now with the vaccinations going up and the pandemic coming to an end that we can, you know, every day brings new changes and fresh changes for us. So we get here and we got a smile on our face and we want to do it again. Even though there might be, you know, unforeseen issues and circumstances we have to deal with.
Yeah. Well, all the great answers. And so you're talking, I was thinking back. I was a bar manager once in Chicago, and I remember my analogy of it was like being a firefighter. Like, I mean, not, you know, just in the sense is you'd go into work and you just, there would be a problem and you would have to figure out how to fix it. Like, you didn't know where it would come from. But that's kind of, as a manager, I think your responsibility. And it's not all problems, but there's things that come up and you don't know what it's going to be.
Sure. But, you know, you get somebody at the end of the night who just loves everything you do and makes it completely worthwhile.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. Passion. Back to passion, for sure. Okay. On that note, let's take a little break and we'll come back and we'll have my speed round game. We'll talk some industry news. I have my solo dining experience and the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
My name is Sarah Kim and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Wisconsin cheese has proven time and time again to be a delicious expression of craft, hard work, and tradition. As a Cheeselandian, I am able to share a Gouda experience with fellow cheese and food lovers nationwide, as well as connect with cheese producers and cheesemongers, taking my love of cheese to another level. I invite you to join Cheeselandia because during these difficult times, it has been even more important to take it easy and get cheesy. The Cheeselandia community and events have been the glue helping to keep us together and connected, and I would love it if you would join me. And let's face it, if you hear the word cheese and get a little hungry, then you've found a place you can call home. To find out more about Cheeselandia, go to cheeselandia.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guests today are chef owner Chris Cipollone and owner operator John Winterman of Francie in South Williamsburg, Brooklyn. We're on location today, which is very fun and exciting to be here with you guys. And now is the really fun and exciting part of the show. So it's my speed round game. So what this is I'm going to name a couple things and you got to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla. You ready?
Ready.
All right, here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat in.
Eat out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, soft cocktail, or champagne?
All the above.
All right.
Agreed.
Okay. Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Yeah, a la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
How do you mean? Are you talking about the size of the plate or what's on it?
However you want to define it.
Large plates.
I'd see perfect portion. I'm going to go in the middle.
Okay. Middle-sized plates?
Yeah, middle-sized plates.
How about communal table or chef's counter?
I like a good chef's counter. I do.
Communal table.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Tipping.
Definitely tipping.
Pizza or pasta?
I'm going to say pasta.
In deference to my chef, I'll say pasta.
You make a good pasta. Pastas. Okay, open kitchen or closed kitchen?
That's an easy one. Open kitchen.
Yeah.
Two more. Cheese plate or dessert? Figure I know what John's going to say.
Do you know me by now?
Well,
cheese plate.
If I was wrong with that, it could have been a both, yeah. But I thought it would be cheese for you.
Oh, I'm going to say dessert.
Okay.
Sure.
Last one is Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
Ooh,
yeah.
Cool.
I feel like I misunderstood the first question. Eat in or eat out? I thought you were talking about like outdoor dining.
Well, I mean, in today's day and age, I guess these things have different meaning, but I meant eat in, like stay at home,
right.
Or eat out at a restaurant or about. And you said.
I said eat in, but I was meaning eat indoors.
Oh, okay.
As indoor dining needs to come back.
Got
that's
it. Well, it has a new meaning now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Well, then that makes you guys even more, I guess, well, that was the one you answered set differently.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. I said go to a restaurant.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, so
we
you
the same
are
thing.
As, yeah, I was a little concerned about the compatibility of you guys, but you definitely came through.
Oh, we're definitely a dysfunctional married couple, but, you know.
Works well.
It's great. Okay, so for industry news, I talked about this a bit on my last show with Amanda Clute, but I, you know, wanted to bring it back up because it's a big deal, and there's a new article that came out yesterday in the New York Times entitled "How Small Restaurants Leveraged Their Pain to Win Stimulus Money. The Independent Restaurant Coalition Turned Tears into Cheers, Urging Owners to Share Their Angst and Use That Emotion to Lobby Congress." And this was by Brett Anderson. And yes, it's talking about the Independent Restaurant Coalition and how they were able to get this Restaurant Act passed. And it's $28.6 billion for the industry. And it's just, I mean, it's impressive. I'm glad the New York Times covered it because for this whole year, the restaurants, you know, has been fighting to, like, help save independent restaurants, and they achieved it. Like, and I think lobbying was not something that anyone probably in this group had done before, and some, except Sam Cass, who was, and Tom Colicchio. I mean, they had some people involved that knew a bit about politics and how it worked, but basically people just like rolled up their sleeves and got to work and were successful. So
yeah.
I'm very happy
very
for
impressive.
Them and proud of them.
Sure.
Do you have any more take on this or?
You know, I hope I think it's congratulations are deserved. I think it's, with what's being talked about, it's probably a drop in the bucket right now, but I hope it does save a lot of independent businesses. So.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's great. You know, let's see how that unfolds.
Yeah, I listened to Amanda Clute's podcast on Eater, and she interviewed Senator Chuck Schumer, and he was, I mean, it was cool. It was a great interview to hear his support for the industry, and he was very involved in it. And he said, she asked him if what would happen after the money ran out, and he's like, we're gonna, you know, like, renew it. Like, we're gonna he said, it will be replenished is what he said. So we'll see. So that's good news.
That would be great.
Just happy for everyone, and see how the money gets dispersed now. Have you looked into that at all?
We have not. We're waiting to see what the parameters are.
Yeah. Well, very cool. Very happy for our industry. And I have a little announcement that I have launched merch sales on my All in the Industry website. And I have some great swag, including All in the Industry hats and totes and host notebooks and pens. And through the end of May, I'm going to be donating 100% of the proceeds of our hat sales to the IRC to help with our continued effort. So you can go to allintheindustry.com/merch and check that out. And I do have some hats for my guest today.
Oh, nice.
So I do bring swag when I do in-person interviews. Okay, so for my solo dining experience this week, I went to a restaurant called Goose Feather. So here's the rundown. The location, 49 East Sunnyside Lane, located in the King Mansion at the Tarrytown House Estate in Tarrytown, New York. The concept, it's paying tribute to the cuisine of Hong Kong with a focus on noodles, Cantonese barbecue, and dumplings. The chef is Dale Talday, formerly of Talday in Brooklyn and Missoni and Rice and Gold in Manhattan. So why did I go? Well, it had been on my list for a while, and it just made sense to me to go. I treated myself to an amazing lunch at Blue Hill Stone Barns for their chef in residence with Chef Omar Tate. And I had a car, and I looked in the map, and I saw where this was. So I'm like, I'm going to go and get takeout and bring it home later, because I definitely wasn't going to eat right away after my lunch. So that's what I did. So my experience, I drove there. I actually did a little detour over the Mario Cuomo Bridge just for fun, because again, I had a car, and why not? And then I drove over to Goose Feather. It was really close to the restaurant's probably like 15 minutes apart. When I arrived on the property, it was an impressive property. Multiple buildings. I found where Goose Feather was. I parked, I went in, I talked with the hostess, and I ordered my takeout. I asked if Dale was there, and luckily he was. I do know him through the industry, and he nicely made a little mocktail for me to have and showed me around the property, and we got to catch up while my food was being made. So that was great. And what did I get? So I overordered, because I did, and I knew Chinese food would be good the next day, so I got 3 dim sum. I got dry aged beef pot stickers, kung pao chicken wings, and crispy shrimp bao, and then for the main, I got crab rice with jalapeno and tobiko. My take, it was all super tasty. Everything went really well together. I especially loved the shrimp bao. I could have eaten more of those. And the crab rice was really awesome, and it was very good the next day. The ambiance, so it's an impressive venue. It's sitting on a hill with 4 separate dining rooms that have character. It has a bar, it has indoor and outdoor lounges and terraces and garden. It's quite a space, worth checking out. Perfect for Chinese food cravings. Interesting tidbit. So Dale is a 3-time chef contestant on Bravo's Top Chef. He competed in season 4, All-Star season 8, and Top Chef Duels. And he's returning as a judge on season 18, which will start airing on April 1st. Personal fun fact, I was born in Miami, but my older sister was born in Tarrytown. And every time I see the name Tarrytown or I'm in the area, I think of that. The cost of this meal was $75, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes, and the website's goosefeatherny.com. Have you guys been? Have you been to Goose Feather?
I have not.
So. Maybe take a little road trip?
Yeah. Let us get settled
here. Off one of these days, you know?
Yeah, well, it was like taking advantage of being in the neighborhood.
Sure.
So I did, and it was great. And that was a couple weeks ago I did that. Okay, so it's time for the final question. My next guest is Justin Smiley. He's the executive chef of Il Buco Elementary, Veneria, and Smiley Pizza in NoHo, New York City. Chris and John, what would you like to ask Justin?
Do you have a question in mind? I think if I remember, I haven't been for a while, obviously, Il Buco, they had the market section up front. And I didn't know if he had expanded that for people to stay open during the pandemic. Is he going to continue to do that? And was it successful for him to be able to do that?
I will ask. I'm planning to go on a pre-show little visit this week, so okay. I'll do a little research myself. But right. It's
bring
a good
me
question.
Some cheese back.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that too.
Different question? Same question?
Yeah. I mean that would. Particular to that business, that was always the end of things that I was intrigued about the book over there. I'd eaten there, but the takeout thing, I wonder if that took off.
So, yeah,
I'll piggyback on that.
Yeah,
and what are people buying?
Oh, that's a good question. And he launched, the Smiley Pizza is a new concept out of Il Buco that he started doing. He didn't have that before. I know that's new from a few months ago.
Right.
And that just reminds me also, I didn't ask you about your Francie at Home, which you've been doing, did that idea kind of just come with the times to?
Yeah, I mean, we were forced into that.
Yeah, it came with the waiting game for restaurants that we opened. So it was a way for Chris and myself and Jimmy to get out of the house for a little bit and just, you know, we may have eaten as much as we sold, but.
A lot of fried chicken.
Yeah.
Yeah, but is it continuing now?
It's still available. Okay. There are certain menu items that don't travel that well, so it's a limited menu available, but it's still there, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, great. Well, you guys are awesome. I can't wait to come back and dine here again, since I am a regular, and I wish you much continued success, and just congratulations for getting through this really hard time, and I'm really glad you guys met and came together.
Yeah, no, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in. Sorry we don't have any bomboloni for you right now.
I'll be back. Yeah, maybe I'll stick around. No, thank you. My guests today have been chef-owner Chris Cipollone and owner-operator John Winterman of Francie. You can check out their website at franciebrooklyn.com. Follow them on social media at franciebrooklyn, at Chef Cipollone, and at John Winterman. Follow me at Sherry Bayer, Bayer PR, at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My website's bayerpublicrelations.com, sherrybayer.com, and allintheindustry.com. All of our shows are archived at heritageradionetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Amanda Wang, and thanks again to Chris and John. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next week with a new show. I hope you'll tune in then. Stay safe and well, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.